Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday, October the 13th. Today, Gordon Brown saves the world, or so he hopes. The Prime Minister believes he's persuaded his fellow world leaders into adopting Britain's blueprint for averting global financial meltdown.
Let us not forget, it's only about a month ago that we were all saying, will Gordon Brown survive until Christmas?
Also today, UK government officials attempt to persuade Iceland to release British savers' money.
They're holding those assets, in a way, as a ransom. And they're saying that they won't release these assets until they know how British savers are going to be reimbursed.
And in other news today, in the US elections, John McCain's campaign is accused of fueling hatred as the Republicans struggle to stop a surge in support for Barack Obama.
It's a bit like watching the stock exchange tumble in New York, watching the McCain campaign at the moment. They're really finding it difficult and being damaged day by day.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, let's have today's news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Britain, the government will carry out its plan to buy up shares in four major banks today. Negotiations have been going on through the weekend and Sunday night with four banks, RBS, Lloyds, TSB, HBOS and Barclays. The government has up to £50 billion to invest and, as expected, it'll take a majority shareholding in RBS and HBOS. Lloyds TSB is due to take over HBOS, though this may now be renegotiated. It's thought Barclays may still be strong enough to remain fully independent and raise funds itself. RBS is in need of most money, the investment expected to mean the chief executive of RBS, Sir Fred Goodwin, will have to resign. It had been his aggressive expansion into new markets, such as US subprime debt, that's been the cause of the run on his bank. The IMF has given its support to the European plan agreed yesterday to bail out their banks. Largely, the Europeans will follow the plan outlined to them by Gordon Brown. The European Central Bank will offer billions to provide funds for banks to lend. Individual governments will support their banks and financial institutions to stop them collapsing under attack on the markets, including investing in their shares. We'll have a full story on the economy shortly in Guardian Daily. Asian markets reacted favourably to the IMF plan. Australia went up, as did others initially at the opening, but then they fell back as dealers speculate that Europe and the USA would see a near recession. The Japanese market is closed today. Also in Asia, North Korea said it will resume dismantling its nuclear weapons programme. At the weekend, the USA finally agreed to the country's demand to be taken off the list that sponsors terrorism. The Korean government's also agreed to allow inspectors from the USA and the UN to resume their work in the country. The Spanish golfer Sergio Ballesteros has announced he has a brain tumour. He's been in hospital for a week after he collapsed, and now a biopsy will be taken to decide whether he needs a full operation. Ballesteros was a winning Ryder Cup captain after he won the Open three times and the Masters twice. Sergio gets a sad picture on the sports pages, quite a few papers, such as The Guardian, though Lewis Hamilton gets a few headlines too, admitting his mistake in being pushed to the back of the pack in the Japanese Grand Prix. He told The Sun he believed his rivals for the driver's title, Felipe Massa, tried to ram him off the track. Yet again, it's the economy that takes over the front pages. Bloodbath of the bankers, says the Mirror, while the Mail focuses on the fact that RBS will need most government cash to save it. Bank boss falls on his sword, reads their headline. There's disagreement about how much it'll cost the government to invest in the banks, from $25 billion upwards, but that's to be expected as negotiations have gone on through the night. The Independent and the Times call the investment nationalisation, while The Guardian and the FT say that it's only an injection of funds or a lifeline. The Telegraph goes further and claims the PM will put his own directors on the board of the banks. It also tells us that there's a perfect storm to come for the rest of us as the crisis hits the real economy. It believes that high street sales will slump as a recession bites and that job losses will follow. As the full details of the British bank bailout are announced, you'll find them all at guardian.co.uk.
Having persuaded G7 leaders to adopt a UK-style bailout plan for the banks, in Paris last night, Gordon Brown said he'd convinced European leaders to follow the British blueprint and prevent global financial disaster.
Look, what we've got to do is stabilise the financial system. So the action that we have proposed is to inject sufficient liquidity into the system to recapitalize banks so that banks can be strong in going about their day-to-day functions, and to provide an incentive for the medium-term funding, which is essential for businesses and for homeowners in the real economy. So that is what we're trying to do in the short term. In the medium term, we have got to rebuild the international financial system.
The British government believes its £500 billion bailout plan for the banks offers the three pillars of liquidity, funding and capital. But Friday's stock market panic wiped £2.7 trillion off global share values. Brown said that underlined the need for coordinated global action to save the financial system. On Friday, finance ministers of the G7 leading industrialised countries agreed to follow Britain's lead and part-nationalise their banks. In Paris yesterday, the Prime Minister met the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, the European Central Bank Chief Jean-Claude Trichet and the European Commission President José Barroso. Then Brown addressed Eurozone leaders, countries whose currency is the euro. Our chief political correspondent is Nicholas Watt.
Well, it was interesting. On Sunday, Gordon Brown travelled to Paris. Now, what was the British Prime Minister doing in Paris? Because it was a meeting of the Eurogroup. That is the 15 members of the European Union who decided to do away with their currency and join the euro. And of course, Gordon Brown, when he was Chancellor, went out of his way to ensure that Britain would not join the euro. And he's always been regarded with suspicion in Europe because of that. But what happened? The leaders of the Eurogroup met at the Elysee Palace under the chairmanship of Nicolas Sarkozy, the President of France, who's running the European Union at the moment, and they invited Gordon Brown. And the reason why they invited Gordon Brown and wanted to hear from Gordon Brown is they are intrigued in the Eurogroup about the £500 billion rescue package that Gordon Brown announced last week. Jean-Claude Trichet, who is the governor of the European Central Bank, thinks that key elements of that plan would be very handy, and he'd like to introduce in the euro area. And the point about the plan that Britain unveiled is that the liquidity elements, the elements in which you allow banks, you guarantee the loans of banks, those elements can only be introduced by a central bank, which in Britain's case is the Bank of England, but in the case of the Eurogroup is the European Central Bank. The other third element of the plan, which is the subject of discussions overnight in Britain, that's the recapitalisation of the banks. That's the semi-nationalisation where Britain puts up for its banks £50 billion, which the banks will allow the banks to sell a stake of their business in the form of preferential shares to the government. That can only be done by individual governments. So if Eurogroup members want to go for recapitalisation, they'll have to decide that element on their own.
Gordon Brown had already persuaded his fellow G7 leaders to adopt the UK bailout model. This is an extraordinary coup for Gordon Brown, isn't it?
Well, it is interesting. It really is quite a coup for Gordon Brown on a number of levels. Firstly, he's always been regarded with great suspicion in the European Union. They were much more favourable towards Tony Blair, who seemed to have Europe in his heart. And here they are now turning to Gordon Brown and saying, that's a really interesting idea. Can we implement it? But the other reason why this is particularly interesting is, let us not forget, it's only about a month ago that we were all saying, will Gordon Brown survive until Christmas? Will Gordon Brown be overthrown by the Labour Party? Will one of the young Turks around the cabinet table, David Miliband and James Purnell, unseat him as Prime Minister? And now, well, what are we doing now? We're now talking about Gordon Brown as the saviour of Europe, indeed maybe the saviour of the world. It does show that in politics, well, the old cliche from Harold Macmillan, a week is a long time in politics. It seems at the moment that a nanosecond is a long time in politics.
And it will be hard for Gordon Brown's critics to accuse him of not showing leadership after this.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Gordon Brown has been criticised over the last year for being indecisive, unable to take a decision, getting too bogged down in the minutiae of government and unable to see the big picture. But hey, you don't get much bigger in big picture terms than a £500 billion rescue plan for banks that the US Treasury Secretary says, oh, that's interesting. And the governor of the European Central Bank says, oh, that's also interesting. What elements can I copy?
Nick Watt. Well, the alternative to coordinated action by world leaders is systemic financial meltdown, according to Dominique Strauss-Kahn, head of the International Monetary Fund. Ashley Seeger, The Guardian's economics correspondent, says all eyes will be on markets today when the exchanges reopen across Asia and Europe.
they really want to, I think, follow the British plan last week. It's quite unusual, I must say, that the British have come up with something that everybody wants to copy. But it's along the lines of the British plan to provide capital for banks where necessary to help with funding and guarantees for money market operations, that kind of thing, because I think world leaders have, A, over the weekend woken up to how serious this is, and B, have realised that before markets open today, they've got to have some credible plan in place.
Do you think the plan that they've got in place is credible enough to stop the markets panicking?
Who knows anymore? These are very difficult times, aren't they? And people thought the British plan would draw a line in the sand, but of course these markets are global and the British plan is a British plan. Is it credible? I think it could be, but markets are in a very, very panicky mood at the moment. And it looks like today we'll see the government taking majority stakes in RBS and HBOS, such as the collapse in their share prices on Friday, meant that any money the government puts in entitles them to a bigger share in those banks now. So we're heading towards effective nationalisation of one or more other banks, possibly the entire system.
And are these signs that the government might actually have to go further than the bailout plan it announced on Wednesday?
Yes, quite possibly. As I was just hinting there, it could be that we have to go for full-scale nationalisation of the banking system. That sounds a radical step. It is a radical step. These are radical times. Ironically, because of the falls in the share prices of these banks, nationalising the entire system wouldn't cost as much as you might think otherwise.
You were quite enthusiastic, Ashley, about the bailout plan. And in fact, there's been, as you've suggested, I mean, the other world leaders seem to have reacted very positively to it. Are there any other plans out there? I mean, what are the other options?
Well, it would be full-scale nationalisation countries and lots of banks, I think. Beyond that, you don't really want to go, because you start to run out of options after that. You have options like closing the banking system for a few days, as Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933. You have options like closing markets for a day or two. None of these are places you really want to go, though, because all they can do is cool things down temporarily. They don't solve any underlying problems. But as I say, if we get these kind of British scale plans adopted globally, that ought to stop the rot. And this isn't to say that I'm backing a British plan because it's British. It's just because it's quite good and it's very comprehensive.
Dominique Strauss-Kahn, head of the International Monetary Fund, said at the weekend that there must be no return to business as usual when the worst of this crisis is over. How will the world's leaders rebuild the financial system, assuming that we get to the point where they've managed to calm the market?
Well, I think as they've had the textbooks out about the Great Crash recently, they'll have to get the textbooks out again about proper banking regulation that they've systematically dismantled over the last two or three decades, not just in Britain, but in other countries too, as they've listened to these bankers who've said, oh yes, if you deregulate us, we'll go off and make loads of money. What they forgot to say was that also they'll build in instability in the system that one day will go pop, and it's now gone pop, and we're in trouble. So these bankers can expect a much changed landscape going forward. And hopefully most of them won't be in their jobs either, I should add.
This sort of landscape that we're looking at, banks will have to be looking at making less profit and have more capital, in essence.
Yes, exactly. Considering that they only made up a fairly small, or not a fairly small, but I forget the percentages now, but their share of profits made in Britain far outweighed their share of market capitalisation in the FTSE, if you see what I mean. They were making much, much bigger profits last year than they were a decade or two decades ago. They're going to have to get used to making less profit. They're going to have to serve the economy rather than have the economy serve them. They're going to have to make normal amounts of profit, and they're going to have to wind in their risk-taking.
Ashley Seeger. Well, UK savers and councils and charities could lose billions of pounds due to the collapse of the banking system in Iceland. The British government seized £4 billion worth of Icelandic assets using anti-terror laws. The Guardian's Robert Booth says British and Icelandic officials are in negotiations trying to find a way out of the impasse.
The Treasury officials and the Financial Services Authority, people who've gone over to Iceland, are demanding that the Icelandic government and the banks repay large portion of the money that was invested by British depositors, British private depositors, just people like you and I who might have invested in the Icelandic banks. There is a system whereby the British government has said that it guarantees deposits up to £50,000 for each individual. And under a kind of Europe-wide agreement, of which Iceland is supposed to be part, they were due to guarantee the first 16,000 of that. That didn't seem like it was going to happen, and Iceland had also talked about paying its own depositors first, and this made Gordon Brown in particular quite angry. So he sent over his best lawyers to try and come to some kind of agreement whereby the Icelandic government and banks will actually repay that money.
The British government has seized £4 billion worth of Icelandic assets using anti-terror laws. How can they repay depositors using these assets, though?
Well, what they seem to be doing, and what Yvette Cooper, who's the one of the Treasury ministers, has said, is that they're holding those assets in a way as a ransom. And they're saying that they won't release these assets until they know how British savers are going to be reimbursed, which is what seems to be a very sort of pugnacious tactic. It contrasts a little bit with the way the Dutch government have gone about solving the same problem. They've said to the Icelandic government, we want the money back for our savers. And instead of holding them to ransom, they've actually offered to loan them the money so they could actually do that, which seems a very different approach.
How might Iceland's banking crisis affect the way UK local authorities are run?
Well, UK local authorities have got large deposits in Icelandic banks, some of them running into sort of £40 million. The Kent County Council has got £50 million there. And these are not the majority of their reserves, but they are sometimes large minorities. And the local authorities are going to government this week to say we need significant bailout funds, really, to see us through this, because this could affect the way we deliver services. They don't think it's going to affect that in the short term. They're just worried in the long term. The Local Government Association yesterday said that the idea that they wouldn't be able to pay council officials was forcing it a bit too far, but indeed there are serious problems coming down the track if they can't guarantee that their money comes back.
And British charities also have money invested in Icelandic banks.
That's right, and it's really it's a bit of a murkier picture. We know for sure that there's about £125 million worth of charity money in Icelandic banks, and at the top end, worst case scenario, there could be as much as £1 billion. And that means that there's been a kind of double whammy for charities, because on the one hand, they're losing money potentially, and on the other hand, at a time when things are getting tight, demands on their services are growing. So, for example, charities that offer financial help are obviously seeing more people coming to them. Charities like the Samaritans are talking about more people coming to them, and so on and so forth. So there's a sort of double squeeze, really. And what's more, in fact, is that other organisations, such as local authorities that have been hit by Icelandic, the problem with Icelandic banks, often had agreements with charities. So charities that provide services, and some of those agreements are turning to dust. So they're getting squeezed on all fronts.
Robert Booth, and there's full coverage of what happens on the markets today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, Charlie Brooker on what it feels like to be in a casino in America while television screens show world markets crashing. Read what he says and have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. The House of Lords votes today on legislation that would allow terror suspects to be detained without charge for 42 days. Full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. And Catherine Whitehorn looks at assisted suicide in Oregon at guardian.co.uk/G2. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, why some men may inherit baldness from their fathers.
When you add the effect of these two genes together, it increases your risk of becoming bald by 7 times.
But first, there's just over 3 weeks to go now until the American presidential elections. Well, with the economic crisis dominating the headlines, John McCain's campaign has been accused by a civil rights leader of sowing hatred and division. And the Republicans have been facing another problem. Alaskan officials published the results of an investigation on Friday which found that McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, used her position as state governor to pursue a private feud with a state trooper. Ed Pilkington's in New York for The Guardian. He told me how this has been affecting the McCain campaign.
Well, it's clearly a blow for the John McCain campaign and for Sarah Palin personally. It was a sort of double-headed finding. On the one hand, it exonerated her, said that she didn't act illegally in firing her police chief. On the other hand, however, it was very damning, finding that she had misused her office in pressurizing officials to sack her former brother-in-law, who, as we know, is going through a very messy divorce with her sister. So, you know, it's clearly not good for her, but she's leaning on the other finding that she was exonerated from actually acting in an unlawful way and is saying, well, that's it, I'm in the clear. It's not going to run like that, but I do think the overall impact of Troopergate is likely to be relatively small in this campaign for two reasons. One, it's now very close to the actual election. It's only 3 weeks away. And two, the overwhelming issue that is dominating all discussion is the financial crisis. And Troopergate looks pretty tiny in comparison with that. So it's a small ripple, I think, as we come into the last few days.
It's difficult for McCain because of the economic crisis, isn't it? Because the economic crisis is so closely associated with the Republican era.
Yeah, I mean, the timing is absolutely appalling for him, and he's suffering virtually with every hour. It's a bit like watching the stock exchange tumble in New York, watching the McCain campaign at the moment. They're really finding it difficult and being damaged day by day, with the polls swinging steadily towards Obama. I mean, the thing that really is killing him is that in recent weeks he's lent very heavily towards the right in his campaign in order to try and drive out the party faithful in the Republican Party to get out there and vote for him, which he was finding difficult. He's known as a moderate. A lot of people on the right don't like him, and he was trying to convince them that he was a genuine conservative by arguing in favour of a burning of regulations, of tax cuts, of small government. And of course, it's precisely that lack of regulation that we're now finding has got us all in this financial mess. So he's in a really difficult position. He's now trying to scramble back from the arguments he made earlier and call for more government intervention, more government spending, which is completely opposite of what he had been saying just a few weeks ago.
McCain's also been fighting an increasingly negative campaign, focusing on Obama's past association with William Ayers, a former member of the Weather Underground terrorist group. Is he likely to get more negative over the next 3 weeks?
Well, it's actually slightly the opposite. Just over this weekend, again, he's been reining back from that. I mean, the story of the McCain campaign at the moment is someone who's floundering around. He's moving in vastly different directions to himself all the time. He's kind of all over the place to some extent. And just this weekend, he reined back quite sharply from what he and particularly Sarah Palin has been doing in recent days, which was driving further and further into negative campaigning territory. Palin notably said that Obama had been palling around with terrorists, which is a pretty memorable expression. But just this weekend, there was a feeling they were coming under such criticism from all around, including from many people in their own party, that they were in danger of whipping up demagogic, ugly feeling within their own supporters that they should stop doing it. There have been comments in among their crowds in rallies that, you know, kill him was one comment from someone in the crowd when they were referring to Obama. And that for many has gone too far. So this weekend, McCain reined back a little bit. He said that Obama was a decent family man and that people should not fear it if he becomes president of the United States, which is pretty extraordinary coming from someone who himself is running for the presidency.
Neither McCain nor Obama have really dwelt on the subject of race during the campaign. Is that likely to change between now and polling day?
Again, there's been a sense just in the last few days that the negative campaigning that McCain and Palin were engaged in was in danger of unleashing a sort of ugly racist undertone in the election. And a very prominent black civil rights activist, John Lewis, who is a hero figure from the 1960s civil rights movement, congressman for Atlanta, accused McCain of the kind of ugly behavior that George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, had famously engaged in back in that period in the civil rights era. So again, they're under pressure on this and they're having to be quite careful. And I think what's likely to happen over the last 3 weeks is that they'll be so sensitive about that that they're going to again rein back and avoid any implication that they're playing the race card.
Ed Pilkington. For some men, losing their hair leads to depression, social shyness, and stigma. And the cause of male pattern baldness, which affects roughly one in three men by the age of 45, is about 80% genetic. Now, scientists have a clearer picture of the genetic link to baldness and why some men may inherit the condition from their fathers. With the details, our science correspondent, Ian Sample.
Identified that was a big cause of baldness, inherited baldness, and we're talking about male pattern baldness, which is the most common type. The interesting thing about this gene was it regulates male hormones in the body, but it's actually found on the X chromosome, which you only inherit from your mother. So the way the genetics pans out is that you can link a man's baldness to his maternal grandfather. So there's that. But what this study brings is that the first evidence which really suggests how there could be genes out there which you can inherit from your father. So this might explain why, you know, you'll be bald as well as your father when your grandfather had an incredibly big bushy head of hair.
What's the significance of the discovery?
I think what's really interesting about it is this is, first of all, only the second gene that's been identified with baldness. But also, when you add the effect of these two genes together, it increases your risk of becoming bald by seven times. So the effect of the two genes working together is absolutely huge. What's also interesting about it, as I was saying, was that you can inherit this gene from your father. So it's the first genetic evidence of inheriting that from the down the male line instead of from your mother's side.
The treatment of baldness is a multi-million pound industry, isn't it? I mean, so will this bring scientists any closer to discovering a cure for baldness?
It's a huge market, and there's something like 8 million people in Britain alone who are affected by male pattern baldness, and the pharmaceutical companies make, as you say, multi-millions out of this. Now, there are some groups who say, who actually find this quite offensive, and they say, well, actually, I'm quite happy with my bald head, and I don't want it to be seen as something negative. That said, there is still a market out there. There are some men who lose their hair, who are bald, who don't want it to be that way. Now, there are treatments out there. How this treatment might work is, in the long term, you could potentially use this to develop some kind of gene therapy cream that you could rub into follicles that would help correct this genetic change that these men have inherited. Now, there is some suggestion that that would be a very plausible thing to do because it's very easy to get access to the follicles. You just massage the stuff into your hair and you could achieve it that way. The other thing is you could actually use, because we're looking at a couple of different genes, you could screen people, which sounds a bit extreme, but you could do this. You could screen people to identify those people who are very likely to go bald. If you inherit both of these, the chances are you'll be balding well before your 50s. You could find them and say, give them treatments early on before their hair follicles have actually started dying off, before they've actually started going bald, and that may just improve their chances of keeping a full head of hair.
Ian Sample. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.